So, good morning, everybody. Namo Avalokiteshvaraya is the correct greeting. We're meeting under his inspiration, even though he's not actively present. Of course, he sits above Padmasambhava's head with Amitabha above. So I know that many of you have come from an order weekend. Oh, hello. and that I hear from a number of those I've spoken to that it was a particularly inspired and inspiring weekend. And reflecting on my theme, which is the principles of the order, I was immediately put in contact myself with moments of the deepest or highest experience of the order that I've had. Moments when something happened in the company that was more than the simple assemblage of individuals. So many at conventions, especially in pujas often, when suddenly everything just leaps onto another level. Apparently, very innocently, there's nothing particularly impressive going on. It's just the order doing puja together, and something happens. But there are very particular moments throughout my career as an order member, which is now 45 years. Particular moments when I've experienced myself completely taken out of myself. One of the most powerful was at the last public preceptors college meeting, where I myself retired. I didn't resign, I retired. And the assembled brethren rejoiced in my merits. They didn't rejoice in my merits in the way that people so often do, which is by talking about one's achievements, which is very nice to have rejoiced in. But everybody talked about the impact that I'd had upon them, the positive impact that I'd had upon them. There are another assemblage of people who could be got together who might give a different story. I'm well aware of that. But all of these were recounting the positive effect that their contact with me had upon them, which was deeply, deeply satisfying, far more satisfying than to be rejoiced in for having built this or started that or whatever. Much, much more telling at my time of life that one has left a sort of permanent impression upon people through something that one's done. I could have said the same about almost all of them, but it was my turn. And during the proceedings, I felt no sort of pride, if you like, that kind of rejoicing doesn't evoke pride. It's quite humbling in a certain way. And because often I wasn't aware that what I'd done or what I'd said had a favorable impact upon the particular individual concerned. But what began to happen, and I know it wasn't just for me, is that we seem to sort of go beyond ourselves. Weak ways in which I can speak about it. And the way it came to me was that I was absolutely convinced that I would never be separated from these people. I would never, ever lose my connection with them, because we were meeting on a level that was beyond space and time, to put it in that way. I knew that should I be reborn, which is pretty likely, I would be reborn with them, in contact with them, would find my way back to them. Of course, these were this was an assemblage of most of my oldest friends in the order, some of whom I knew before I was an order member. Nagabodhi was there. Dhammadina wasn't there, although she sent her a message and was there in spirit, had been there a couple of days before. But Nagabodhi I knew before I joined the order. And many I knew from very early on in my career as an order member. Parami was there, for instance. So these were people I knew deeply and had worked together with deeply over many, many years, and, you know, struggled with at times again and again over the years. But I think what I experienced was typical of the order, if you see what I mean. It was the kind of experience that one has with the order, but in this case it was particularly concentrated because of our long, long connection and our very close cooperation together in the Public Preceptors College, which does exemplify the spirit of the order to a very high degree. But I think it's worth us all maybe beginning these few days by recollecting moments when we feel we've touched on something about the order that is more than a collection of individuals, more than a particular structure, more even than a set of ideas or anything of that kind. I think it might be worth in your groups just spending a little time connecting with that experience, should you have had it, and I'd find it hard to believe that you haven't. I think it would be worth everybody just saying a few words about something of that experience, because this is what I'm hoping we're going to unfold during these days. If we can really connect with that spirit that transcends us as individuals, that emerges out of our membership of the order, or rather that our membership of the order emerges out of, then I think we can begin to look more deeply at what that means and signifies in more practical terms. I can think of other experiences that I've had that exemplify this spirit in a quite different way. I can think of times when I've been operating on my own. Most recently, and I've talked about this in other talks to the order, I've experienced this in Hungary, where I went for many years mostly on my own. Very difficult set of circumstances for me personally. Not in any unpleasant way, but such a big gap, partly because of the cultural circumstances. I'm a white Englishman speaking to gypsy Hungarians, Hungarian gypsies, who don't even like to think of themselves as Hungarian. They're very, very acute sensitivities, which I'm hardly aware of. And, you know, every now and again put my foot in the wrong place. And took a long time for me to get any sort of acceptance from them and for me to cross a boundary in my relationship to them where they, I think, trusted me and where a real friendship developed between us, which I now feel quite strongly. I feel a great loyalty and appreciation of them for what they do. And where the interest in the Dhamma was very marginal. It was mainly through Dr. Ambedkar's message. Ariyasaki knows the situation well. And the social implications of the Dhamma. And for many years, I'd just go there. Sometimes I'd no idea why I was there. And no idea why to keep going. Because, you know, my deep, deep concern is with the Dhamma. And yes, I want to see a new society emerging, but I want to see it emerging out of the Dhamma. I'm not just interested in social change, because I don't think social change without the Dhamma is a lasting. So quite frustrating, and actually I was often quite unhappy. I was only there for short periods of time, but sort of wondering what I was doing, why I was there. But always what I'd find was that I was not alone. Even in a situation where I did feel so very much alone immediately, I didn't feel alone because I carry the order in me. I carry the order with me. I knew that I was bringing something that was more than me and that I was trying to connect them too. And I thought of it as the order, not as the Dhamma, although, you know, where do you draw the line between them? But I suppose because for me personally, as it were, psychologically, the experience was of loneliness. So I was conscious of the context of the order that I brought with me, that brought me there in a way. It felt almost more like that, and which relieved me of a certain burden. I didn't have to do anything. I just had to be there and connect, and slowly the order would connect with that community, which slowly it's doing, as Ariosaki and others have been coming and connecting with them and forming their own connections. Well, they're beginning to be part of our larger movement. But this, for me, in a number of situations, that's an especially sharp one, has been a very strong sustaining influence. No, not influence, a sustaining force. I've been carried by my membership of the order, not as a theory, not as an idea, but as a lived experience. I've been completely confident that I am but a sort of physical representation of something far larger than me. So again, if you can relate to what I'm talking about, I think it'd be a good idea to start by connecting with that amongst you, so that you connect with this experience of what arises when order members come together, and with the experience of being out of the order, as it were, and carrying that with you. I can imagine, Vajracchakshu, it's all that sustains you at times, on your own in difficult circumstances. I imagine this sense of the order as something that is in you, is not merely at the end of an email or at the end of a flight. It's something that you carry within you. I can't understand how you would do it otherwise. But yes, let's all try to reflect and connect with those sorts of experiences, because it's this that I want to try and bring out a bit more and see what emerges from. Because to me it seems that without that, any discussion about the order is not worth the words that are used in uttering. It's not worth the paper it's printed on. Without some strong sense of this transcendent dimension to the order, any talk about the order is merely about an organization, merely about a sociological phenomenon. So this, of course, we identify with, or Bhante identifies with, the image of the 11-headed, 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara, about which more anon. But I want to approach this first by talking about the difference between the order as a spatio-temporal phenomenon and the order as something ideal that transcends space and time. And I'm going to refer back to a point that I made in a talk many years ago at Padmaloka on the order. In the second set of talks I gave about the order, I referred to a passage from an essay by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, the English poet and thinker. In fact, Bhante refers to him as perhaps the greatest English thinker. I think he meant English in the exclusive sense here. So he's not going up against Wee Davy, or the great Irish for that matter. But it, albeit a very unorganized presenter of his ideas, Coleridge is especially brilliant in making clear distinctions with a strong sense of the transcendent. In the essay that I'm referring to, he is talking about the constitution of church and state. This was his last paper, which was about the place of Catholic emancipation in the English legal system, as it were. We won't go further into that. Interesting, but we won't go further into it. But in talking about the constitution, which famously Britain doesn't have a written constitution, he says, well, it may not have a written constitution, but a constitution isn't really merely something written. It's something that is more than a set of words, which is a very interesting point for current debates. But be that as it may, he makes a distinction between the concept of a thing and the idea of a thing. I won't read you directly what he says, even though it's put in such crisp and clear terms. Or maybe I will, because it is put in such crisp and clear terms. He says, by an idea, I mean in this instance, that conception of a thing which is not abstracted from any particular state, form, or mode in which the thing may happen to exist at this or that time, nor yet generalized from any number or succession of such forms or modes, but which is given by the knowledge of its ultimate aim. To unpack that a little, what he's saying is that what he means by an idea is not a concept or a thought that you derive from looking at particular exemplifications or phenomena, statistics or whatever. A concept, on the other hand, is drawn from your experience of particulars. So, for instance, you could write a sociological thesis on the order, which has been done. And the sociological thesis on the order assembles facts about the order. It's founded at such and such a time by such and such a person. It has such and such a form, so many members in so many countries. It does this, it does that, it has this structure, and so on. All important stuff. But he says that the idea is something more than or different from the concept. And what we're going to try to see as we go on is that the concept, or rather the phenomena from which the concept is drawn, only have meaning if they refer to the idea, in the case of something like the order. So the idea, he calls it a conception, but actually I think here Coleridge is talking at too low a level for what we mean by the order. We're not talking about a conception of the order, we're talking about an idea which is more than conceptual, which goes beyond the concept. We're talking about the order in the terms that I've already spoken, that experience of something transcendent that expresses itself through the phenomenon of the order, but which is more than any particular phenomenon. And I think Coleridge, in a way, is a little defeated by his own language, because he sort of means that, actually, something that ultimately cannot be put into words. And that, yes, we use a word, we use a concept, like the order. But the concept, the order, doesn't merely indicate a conception. It doesn't merely indicate the abstraction, the categorization, derived from the observation of many particular examples. The idea of the order is something to be experienced, something to be realized, something that goes beyond those phenomena. Interestingly enough, he says that though many people may be possessed by an idea, not many people possess the idea. We'll come back to that later, because I think there's a very, very important point in this.
Could you just run through the difference between idea and concept again? I'm not sure I'm getting it.
My goodness, how foolish of you. But it must be because you're not speaking English properly. Yeah. So, if we're asked about the order weekend, what is an order weekend? Well, an order weekend consists of all those who've been duly ordained, who are eligible to come. In this instance, it consisted of such and such a person, such and such a person. This was the program. This is where it took place. So you could tell anybody about that. You could write a passage on it in a sociological PhD. You could give somebody a definition of the concept of an order weekend, if you like. But when you're at the order weekend, does that define it? Is it limited to that? Well, I think if it was at all successful as an order weekend, it does not. That at some point something is touched on that goes beyond that. Yes? So that the idea of a thing is something that is more than its phenomenon. So that the idea of the order is more than the order's temporal, spatio-temporal expression. It's something that goes beyond it. You don't look happy, but I think enough people are happy for you to have to wrestle. I'd prefer not to have a debate during the, I'm sorry, but I can't carry on my thoughts in that way. I think the distinction is actually relatively simple. The conception is, well, concipio, it's a gathering together, taking together. So you observe particular phenomenon, you aggregate them, and you identify that under a category. It's a logical process. Whereas the idea takes one to a higher value. It introduces the notion of value. Perhaps that would be the best way of putting it. So that the order as value is different from the order as phenomenon. Although the order as phenomenon only really is effective if it relates to the order as value. So, of course, the distinction that I'm making is more familiarly made by speaking of the order as a phenomenon, so many chapters, so many order members, such and such a structure and so forth, on the one hand, and the order as expressed by the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. So in my reading of what Coleridge is saying, the idea of the order is the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. The concept of the order is a particular set of structures, etc. We do things this way. A particular set of individuals, a particular process of ordination, and so forth. But the idea of the order always goes beyond that, and is never fully expressed by its phenomena. And the idea doesn't change through time. The idea transcends time. This is what's especially important about the distinction between concept and idea. In Coleridge's usage, you won't find this in the dictionary. So the order as an idea, in the Coleridgean sense, is never going to change. And its phenomena are an ever-changing attempt to express the idea within space and time, hopefully with continuity, but always above and beyond space and time. It's, for me, very real experience. I've been an order member for 45 years, and you cannot imagine how much it's changed. Asperjeet's been ordained for 47 years. The phenomenon of the order has changed phenomenally. It's very, very different in many ways, and there are many things that are almost unrecognizable now. We used to all just sit round in a single room at the front of Aryatara, and we all knew each other. There's so many things about the order are different. Some might say better, some might say worse. Some look back to the good old days, some regret all the sins of the bad old days. But be that as it may, there have been huge phenomenal change. But I can't say myself that I feel my idea of the order in the Coleridgean sense has changed at all. It has deepened and it's clearer, But what it actually is not different at all. So I find it so surprising when people say, this isn't the order that I was ordained into. To my mind, that is can only be the case at the phenomenal level, at the conceptual level. I suspect that what happens is that one loses contact with the idea of the order, or can no longer see the idea of the order through the phenomenon of the order. That's the tricky bit, isn't it? Seeing the two as connected. But I suspect that's what happens to people. I've experienced it myself once or twice. You just sort of stop seeing the order as related to the idea of the order. You see it as simply an assemblage of, well, of course, one sees them all as stupid, bumbling, contemptible fools, not like oneself. You know what I mean, in one's worst moments, the order sort of disappears. But that's because one's lost contact with the idea of the order, or one no longer believes that the idea of the order can be expressed through the phenomenon of the order. I can't say I've ever lost that for anything more than a passing moment. That always one must feel that the idea of the order hovers sort of above, behind, within the phenomenon of the order. I'm very struck by the way Bante seems to think in this regard. I reread recently parts of Facing Kanchenjunga, Facing Mount Kanchenjunga, and Bante talks about the work that he was doing, the Young Men's Buddhist Association, Stepping Stones, and so forth. And he talks about an iridescent ball that hovers in the atmosphere. A very striking poetic phrase, and that is just... they can't quite get hold of it. There's something that's being worked out that is more than the particulars of what he's doing. And, you know, sometimes he says that iridescent ball sort of descends, comes closer. Sometimes it hovers further above. So that the Bante clearly has a very vivid sense of idea. Of a reality, a transcendent reality that is attempting to express itself within space and time. So this is our topic. I hope that Vajranatha works out the distinction, because otherwise he's doomed. The idea of the order, Bante expresses through the image of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. And I think that there's more for us to work with here than perhaps I've ever realized. I've thought about this in terms of the whole idea of incarnation. You know that in the Tibetan tradition, various Rinpoches are considered to be the incarnations of particular bodhisattvas. Famously, the Dalai Lama is thought of as an incarnation of Avalokiteshvara. And again, reading Facing Mount Kanchenjunga, Bante talks about his first contact with Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche. And he talks about him as revered as an embodiment of Manjushri, and that's why it's called Jamyang, because Jamyang is the Tibetan for Manjushri. And I have to say, I've not really ever thought about this, and perhaps been a little sceptical of the whole idea of a human being embodying. But around the time I was reading this, I was doing various sadhanas with members of the Indian ordination teams, and I was doing the Tara sadhana and the Avalokiteshvara sadhana, in both of which you identify yourself with the bodhisattva. And particularly with the Avalokiteshvara sadhana, I had a very, very powerful experience of identification, which is odd because it's not really an identification in the sense that I, little old Subhuti, am now Avalokiteshvara. It's more like I am possessed by Avalokiteshvara, and my little phenomenon is sort of filled out or really clothes that embodiment, which is something enclothes that reality that is far more than me. And I think that's really what we're trying to do in our visualization practices generally, whether they contain production within or production without. In the Manjushri Stuti Sadhana, which I do every day, you bring Manjushri within yourself. And in Manjushri's consciousness, as it were, takes over your consciousness to the extent that you're able to sustain it. So I think the principle of embodiment, of incarnation, is extremely important in our style of practice. I think it's particularly important because it works against our tendency to individualism that is proudly gained from, you know, European Enlightenment, when we got rid of so much superstition and so forth. It's a really important human achievement. But I think it goes too far when we become unaware of the frailty, fragility, artificiality, constructed nature of our individuality. And we become fixated upon it. It's a miserable condition of humanity. When you're solely identified with I, if the sum total of the universe is I, poor universe. So the whole point about spiritual practice is to go beyond that. It's not necessarily to disintegrate it, but it's to see it in proportion, to see it from a higher, larger perspective, where it attains its proportion. Because in a way, insofar as you are a living, breathing being, there has to be a center of experience and a center of agency, which is the minimum that one can mean by I. You see what I mean? That my senses organize my experience as if there was a single observer. And when I make my decisions in space and time, I make them from this point in time for a future time, which I have to conceive myself as existing within. So for agency and for perception, at least short of full and perfect enlightenment, there needs to be some identity. But that identity must be surrendered to something far larger. It must be surrendered to an idea, in Coleridgean terms, that transcends that individuality, if you see what I mean. So the whole point of our practice is that it allows us to open up to a reality that transcends our own without reinforcing our sense of individuality. The problem with our Western culture is that if we adopt spiritual practice from that perspective, our spiritual development becomes a personal achievement. And, you know, we see this phenomenon in modern Buddhism. Attainment becomes something personal. So one's a supposed and transcendence is simply a refinement upon self-clinging. Better refined self-clinging, I suppose, but it's still self-clinging. So I think that is especially important for us who live in materialist, individualist times to be connecting with a reality that transcends us, that we allow to, as it were, take us over, as it were, allow ourselves to surrender to and experience ourselves as serving. So the whole point of our practice is to serve an embodiment of a reality that transcends ourselves, to serve the embodiment of the idea rather than merely the phenomenon. And I'm very struck again by something Bhante said about his seeking initiation from Chetosangye Dorje. He wanted to know who his Yidam was. And Bhante puts it in sometimes what are quite sort of simple, almost naive terms, but which are really very refreshing. He wanted to know, you know, who he really was, what his higher self was. And he didn't think that he was qualified to say what his higher self was. That wasn't for him to do, because if I say what my higher self is, well, all I'm doing is projecting my idea of myself, in other words, my self-clinging, onto myself. So it becomes a sort of transcendent ego. So he wanted somebody who he trusted, who he believed could tell, to tell him. And he he awaited opportunities and eventually was recommended to see Chetosangye Dorje and was very quickly deeply impressed by him and then requested him to tell him who his Yidam was. Rinpoche apparently just reflected for a few moments and then said, "Green Tara." And so Bhante in the book spends a paragraph or so reflecting on that this was his real self. This was who he really was outside time, beyond time. Which I found a very, very powerful idea. You know, I've read that so many times, but it really struck home to me. And again, Bhante, sometimes this is the thoroughly medieval Bhante. He's quite sort of simple about these things. He doesn't get complicated in this sort of area. He's quite willing to just put himself into that framework of ideas. So, the idea is that we each exist on different levels, on different planes. You know, if one wanted to, one could isolate out all the different levels. There's even sort of angelic levels. You know, perhaps the guardian angel, as it were, is oneself on the Devaloka levels. And then there's oneself on these higher levels, which are embodied in the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And actually, I think this principle of the phenomenal in relation to the transcendental runs all the way through the world of value. I'll see if I can explain what I mean. This is an insight which doesn't have words. Anything that has value, that is not connected with mere quantity, that is connected with quality, has its roots in the transcendent. So ethics without the transcendent is merely a convention or a sort of humanistic reasonableness. You saw the poor old Kant trying to desperately find out the bases of ethics and tries to derive it from his own idea of reason. Although Kant's idea of reason sometimes sounds pretty much like transcendental experience, but that's another question. In the end, he has to sort of bring in God, although what he means by God is something much more familiar to us. Ethics without some transcendent, something that transcends us as individuals and our individual interests and even our collective interests, you know, being polite to each other because then we'll get on better and it'll be better for everybody. If that's all there is to ethics, I'm out of here. Ethics has to be based in something that is rooted in the ultimate meaning of the universe. Otherwise, it easily just falls apart and falls into self-interest. I think there's a very interesting discussion about democracy in this respect, and maybe we'll come back to this later. Dr. Ambedkar is very aware of this. The democracy has to be an idea. Well, he calls it an ideal, but it has to be an idea in this sense. If it isn't an idea, in the Coleridgean sense, it simply becomes competing interest groups, as we see in our own modern times. There's populism. It's the entry point for populism. If there isn't an idea of democracy that's rooted in ethics, and an ethics that's rooted in a transcendent idea, democracy simply becomes just perhaps a somewhat better way of arranging for the transfer of power and the dominance of a one majority over a minority. You'd be a Dalit in India, democracy looks very different. You'd be a gypsy in Hungary, democracy looks very different. So yes, anything that is touched by value has its roots in the transcendent. And anything that is transcendent has its archetypal form. This is an idea that used to be very, very familiar. Of course, you find it in the whole, particularly the Hellenistic era, where, you know, all virtues had their gods and goddesses, where even in a general pagan religion, towns have gods and so on. Any aggregation of mind of any kind has its transcendent dimension, and that transcendent dimension has its archetypal embodiment. I can't say why. It's not something I'm trying to argue. I'm just saying it's true. It's a fact that any collection of any aspect of mind, anything that is touched by value, that is, has its archetypal form. Blake was very aware of this. The several of his pictures are of the genius of this or that, the spirit of. So you can see where I'm coming from or where I'm going. The order has an archetypal form. Sometimes when this is talked about, even in some things that Bhante talks about, where Bhante talks about the order as the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, it sounds more like a sign than a symbol. In other words, it's a way of making a point. You know, we're all hands of Avalokiteshvara. And it's a sort of a pretty picture, as it were. Sorry, I don't want to sound too contemptuous. But it just sort of, it's a way of saying something, that we are all connected, we're all linked. But actually, I think what's implied is something far, far more than that. What's implied is a reality that exists, as it were, above, beyond, behind, within the order as phenomenon, and which is expressed archetypally in the form of Avalokiteshvara. That's my main point. That the image of Avalokiteshvara is the embodiment of this spirit that I mentioned at the beginning. This spirit that I hope everybody has some experience of in order events, that one has an experience of when one's on one's own and feel one carries the order with one. This spirit of the order, which is more than just the fact of the order, which is something that the order as fact, to a greater or lesser extent, does embody, does channel. This is the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. And if we are to deepen and better embody what the order is, we need in one way or another to more systematically, I believe, connect with what that image implies. If you see what I mean. It may not mean that you have to visualize the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, although I'm going to put a case for that being a jolly good thing for us to do collectively. It may be that it's sufficient for one to take the sort of experiences that I hope you've all have had and to try to soak yourself in them, try to connect with them and to even take upon oneself to the discipline of connecting with them. Because I think being a member of the order requires discipline. I shall say much more about that in a while. It's something where one has to give some things up, where one has to make certain efforts, where one has to lay aside certain things which may be of personal interest, but are not necessarily in one's best interests. One has to discipline oneself. And one of the ways in which one has to discipline oneself is by, I think, systematically trying to connect with the idea of the order, perhaps through the image of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. We're going to experiment with that. We're going to explore that during these days. We're going to visualize the image of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara and identify ourselves with that image and see what comes from that, what that does to one. How one finds oneself in relation to that, and whether one's able to connect that with the spirit of the order or not. Maybe not. It's an experiment. Personally, I do, and I can, but it may not be the same for everybody. But we do need to connect with that idea of the order as something beyond the phenomenon of the order. And that needs to be something done systematically. Of course, our order metta is an attempt to do that, and a very effective one when we do it, because the spirit of metta that we encounter, especially as we get into the later stages of the practice, is of the essence of the order. But to me, it seems that the idea of the order as something transcendent also needs a more systematic cultivation. To some extent, we do that through our own practices, because we all share a common range of practices, ideally. And again, this is something that Bhante wants us to do for this reason, so that we've all got a common vocabulary of ideas, or the embodiments of the idea. But I think the connection with the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara could be a very important way for us to further develop this. Bhante, a long time ago, did ask us to put quite a bit of work into this. I had some trouble finding this. I could remember it, but I couldn't find out where it came from, but it's from 15 points for new and old order members. There's another set which is 15 points for old and new or something like that. But this was the original one. I was there. It was given in Tuscany, and sorry, in Guhyaloka. No, it was actually given in Tuscany in 1980 something or other, eight. Yes, says Guhyaloka, but it was Tuscany. I was there. So point number 5 of the 15 points is try to realize the unity of the order. You all know that the unity of the order is symbolized by the figure of the 11-headed and thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. One could say that each of these 11 heads symbolizes a chapter. Of course, we've got more than 11 chapters, but leave that aside. And then each order member is represented by one of the thousand arms and hands joined onto the body of Avalokiteshvara. And of course, each hand holds a single implement, a flower, wheel, vase, bow and arrow, and so on. And those particular instruments represent the particular activity of each order member. They symbolize each individual's particular talent, the gift that each makes to the order and movement, even to the world as a whole. But those symbols, all those implements, hands, arms, heads, are all integrated into the body of Avalokiteshvara, which is the order, which is the order. So it is very important that, as an order member, one feels oneself to be one of these arms of Avalokiteshvara, a limb or member of the whole order, and that one tries, as much as one can, to realize the unity of the order. So what does that mean? How does one try to realize the unity of the order? How does one try to experience oneself as a hand or arm of Avalokiteshvara. How does one actually do that? Probably in a way we all know what that means, but I'd like us to try and adumbrate that. I'd like us to bring it into the light, to make it a bit more conscious, and to see what we actually do in order to try to realize the unity of the order. I feel this does need emphasizing again and again and again. Sometimes you hear or see things being done within the order that, at least to me, seem to break the unity of the order. I don't mean disagreement. Disagreement is not necessarily breaking the unity of the order. I mean something much more subtle, much more destructive even, which does not honour the unity of the order whilst trying to deepen it, if you see what I mean. Disagreement can be an attempt to realise the unity of the order more fully, because, you know, the current understanding has plateaued or whatever. It can be. So I'm not at all talking about dissent. I think dissent is inevitable and not necessarily destructive at all. Not that dissent is valuable, if you see what I mean. I don't like that language. It's not that being dissenting is itself a value. But I don't think dissent should be squashed. I think dissent should be engaged with. And it may be a genuine attempt to deepen the sense of the unity of the order. Often is. Done it myself. So, what does it mean to realize the unity of the order? How do you do it? Do you do it? Maybe you don't think about it, which may be fine. It's fine to be possessed by an idea rather than to possess the idea. For many, I'd say many of my brothers and sisters in India don't think too much about these things, but they feel it very deeply and strongly, actually in some ways much more strongly than people often do here. It's much more sort of basic to them. If we make it more conscious, we may be able to deepen it yet further, and we may be able to help each other to deepen it yet further. And maybe some deeper connection with the image of the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara may help us in that effort. Let's see. This is a bit of an experiment. Bhante goes on, the next point, point number six, is identify with the order as a whole. One's feeling that one is an arm of Avalokiteshvara should be a very strong, which should be very strong indeed. It should be sufficiently strong, at least, to enable one not to over-identify with one's own particular chapter or centre. It is very easy to lose sight of the movement as a whole when you're spending your whole time within a particular chapter and around a particular centre, just meeting other order members connected with that centre, working for that centre, perhaps very efficiently and loyally. It is very easy to lose sight of the whole figure of Avalokiteshvara and to focus on one particular head or even just one or two or three particular arms. So one must try not to do that. Of course, one must be loyal to one's own chapter and one's own centre, working for it wholeheartedly. But one must see that one's own centre and chapter are only part of something which is very much bigger and very much more important than any particular centre or chapter, however big and however good. And this should be a real and very strong feeling. So how do we do that? How do we try to identify with the order as a whole? Probably easier if you're on your own, like Vajracchakshu, because what else is there? It's a very big problem in India, because people live very locally, and they're part of a culture that it has very strong traditional group identity. Very easy for people to form into factions and groups. It's not so common in the West, but it does happen. It may be because it's more subtle, it's in a sense more pernicious. Sometimes it goes along more the lines of interest groups, particular sort of practice groups or something like that, which then become polarized with the rest of the order. So Yes, one needs to avoid these specific actions, but it seems to me that Bhante is talking about something more than merely the practical application of that, although the practical application is very important. It's in order to identify with the order as a whole, you have to have a sense of the order as a whole. How can you have a sense of something that you don't have an experience of, if you see what I mean? I don't think I've ever been with every single order member, ever. In whatever the circumstance, there's always somebody missing. And it's impossible now. We'll never get the whole order together again. So realizing the identifying with the order as a whole is not going to be a matter of, as it were, sense perception. And it must be something more than merely an idea. I mean, an idea or concept rather. Yes, concept. It must be more than just a concept that, oh, there are all these order members and we all went for refuge in the same way and we all went through the same ordination. Although that's helpful to me to think that. But what I end up with is something that is more than an assemblage of individuals. There's something more like an idea, or something more like the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. So again, I'd like us to explore in groups how we identify with the order as a whole. Probably easier for those who live at distances, but for those of us who live where the order is thick, accumulated, coagulated, not to say, it's more difficult. And there's a very strong tendency to identify with our particular collection of order members. But how do we break that down? How do we break it down practically? But how do we break it down in imagination, even in realization? I find it very interesting that Bhante says, realize the unity of the order. Realize the unity of the order. So clearly he's talking about something more like an idea, an archetypal experience, an idea that is beyond mere concepts. So how do we do that? It's of the greatest importance that we, I think, make this more conscious, because I think it's getting harder and harder with the growth of the order to sustain a more concept and sense-based idea of the order. It's getting more and more difficult. And with the proliferation of ideas within the order, which is in many ways very valuable, it becomes more difficult to see how you fit together, where you meet. So I think the experience of the transcendent dimension of the order becomes more and more urgent the more we grow in size, and the more distant we become from Bhante. Because Bhante has for us, to some extent, embodied the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. We'll say more about this later, but it's through him that the idea of the order has taken embodiment. And, you know, he quite explicitly said it was something that came into being through him, not by him. So as we get further from him, and as people's personal acquaintance with him disappears, it's going to be more and more important to sustain this idea of the order. And it's important that we do that because we have to embody the idea of the order. Just as we have to embody the idea of Avalokiteshvara, the idea of Manjushri, Padmasambhava, whoever it is upon whom we meditate, we're trying to embody that idea through our lives. So our collective life has to embody the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara. And in order to do that, I'm suggesting a greater degree of consciousness of how we realize the unity of the order and how we realize, identify ourselves with the order as a whole. How we do that becomes more and more important. And the discipline that is connected with us doing that needs to become more conscious. And it cannot be left merely to our personal sort of, goodwill and good fortune. So I hope I've given you some food for thought and some food for discussion. I'm hoping that you've grasped the main point that I'm making, and that you'll be able to discuss together how you would give that greater embodiment and expression. Because in the end, for me, this is the main practice I'm engaged in. I'm engaged in the practice of trying with all of you to manifest the Thousand Dan Devalokiteshvara. That's my practice within the world, to the extent that I remember it, and to the extent that my life is worthwhile, I do remember it. That is what we're really engaged in, manifesting the 11-headed Thousand Dan Avalokiteshvara. So let's see what you make of that, and we'll see where we go tomorrow. Thank you.